God would give me some sign. If he would just speak to me once. Anything, one sentence, two words. If he would just cough.
Of course there's a God. We're made in his image.
You think I was made in God's image? Take a look at me. You think he wears glasses?
Not with those frames.
Despite humorists like Woody Allen, the question of God's existence is no laughing matter. From law to morality to our own eternal existence, everything crumbles with God out of the picture. Discover why this week on Just Thinking with author and apologist Ravi Zacharias. Throughout this week, we've heard Ravi Zacharias share insights into the destruction and confusion caused by the philosophy of atheism. Today, he's going to wrap up his message with a look at what ultimately brings meaning. Let's listen in as he concludes his fascinating presentation, Is Atheism Dead? Is God Alive?
There is a powerful struggle within the heart. The heart that struggles to find some sense of sanity that will make consistency out of all that we believe. And it was G.K. Chesterton, one of the most scintillating journalists of this century, G.K. Chesterton, who said it was after reading The Atheist that he became a Christian. It was after he read The Atheist that turned him ultimately to God. And G.K. Chesterton makes a profound statement in his book, Orthodoxy. And I want you to listen because it'll be worth your while just listening to the brilliant way in which he has described the struggle of the person without God. He said, the new rebel in our time is a skeptic and will not entirely trust anything. He has no loyalty. Therefore, he cannot even be a true revolutionist. And the fact that he doubts everything gets in his way when he wants to denounce anything. For all denunciation implies a moral doctrine of some kind. And the modern revolutionist doubts not only the institution he denounces, but the doctrine by which he denounces it. So thus, he writes one book complaining that imperial oppression insults the purity of women. Then he writes another book, a novel, in which he insults it himself. He curses the Sultan because Christian girls lose their virginity, then curses Mrs. Grundy because they keep it. As a politician, he cries out that war is a waste of life, and then as a philosopher, that all life is a waste of time. A Russian pessimist will denounce a policeman for killing a peasant, and then prove by the highest philosophical principles that the peasant ought to have killed himself. A man denounces marriage as a lie, then denounces aristocratic profligates for treating it as a lie. He calls a flag a bauble, then blames the oppressors of Poland or Ireland because they take away that bauble. The man of this school goes first to a political meeting where he complains that savages are treated as if they were beasts, then he takes his hat and umbrella and goes on to a scientific meeting where he proves that they practically are beasts. In short, the modern revolutionist, being an infinite skeptic, is always engaged in undermining his own minds. In his book on politics, he attacks men for trampling on morality. In his book on ethics, he attacks morality for trampling on men. Therefore, the modern man in revolt has become practically useless for all purposes of revolt by rebelling against everything. He has lost his right to rebel against anything. One of the turning points in my life came not just when I had made my commitment to Christ, some of the reasons and the rationale of which I will give to you tomorrow as we move through the existential struggle of defending that view, but shortly after I became a father. I was speaking in Cambodia. The country was falling into ruin, and a few weeks later it was going to completely collapse. I recall standing there as I left a troubled nation, seeing a lot of death and destruction, and my heart was quite overwhelmed by it all. And as I had come back home, I was living in Toronto at that time, a very significant thing happened, albeit in a moment, but it somehow bound together so much in my life. My wife had picked me up from the airport, and my little girl Naomi was just learning how to walk. Now, you need to know a little bit about her. When she was born, I happened to be out of town. She came a little earlier than she should have. And when my wife phoned me and told me she was born, what else could I do but hurry up and get on a plane and come back? And as I flew back, I decided to go to the, of course I was going to the hospital, but I decided to go to Margie's room first rather than stop by in the nursery, as tempting as it was. But I decided to do the right thing, because then someday I could use it in an illustration and sound so noble about it all. So I was walking by the nursery. You've got to be a dead human being, really, to not have a baby, a newly born baby, just stir up your imagination. And as I was walking by, I decided I wouldn't look, except the corner of my eye captured one little infant by the window. And the reason it captured me, because the hair wasn't lying down. The hair was at a 45-degree angle, just ready to take off. And I looked at that baby and said, what a cute little Eskimo child, because the cheeks were so pudgy, the eyes were not visible, until I suddenly realized that wasn't any Eskimo child. That was my little daughter. The name was right on top. Hair zooming out like that, eyes not visible. I couldn't believe this was my own little girl. As cute as you'd want to see them. And I decided, resist the temptation, go and see Margie first. Now, when she, as she grew up for the first year or two, that hair wouldn't sit down. It just aimed in that direction. So I arrived back from this desolating experience, walked into the home, and Naomi, Nimi as we called her, was standing in her walker. And as we arrived at the home where she was, and my mother-in-law was keeping an eye on her by the kitchen table, little pudgy little body of hers trying to keep on her feet, as she leveled her gaze at me, I stared back, and I didn't even know if she would be able to recognize me. We stared for about a moment or so, and suddenly she just about flipped over herself, darting in my direction, shot out both of her arms. And I picked up that little one, wrapped my arms around her, and as she nestled that soft face of hers against my shoulder for about a solid minute, as I just clutched onto my own little offspring, and saw Grandma sitting at the kitchen table's eyes well up with tears there, and Margie standing there just beaming with a sense of contentment. Can I tell you this as honestly as I can? In about that one solitary moment, I think I learned a lot more about life than a few dozen books that I had read prior to that. There is a clue to meaning in life, and that clue comes in relationships. Why is it in a dark dungeon in the Becca Valley, while atheistic journalists are chained by some young terrorists of our time and chained against their will, why is it in a dark, damp, solitary room that even a hard-nosed atheist like the French journalist says he found God? Terry Anderson comes back and says, all of a sudden life began to take on a completely different dimension. And when you read his poetry that he muttered to himself, which he wrote as soon as he got away from there so that he wouldn't forget it, he talks about the loneliness and the dark night of the soul. He talks about the desolation and the anger, and he marvelously captures one or two ideas. He said, as the more I tried to condemn my captors, I realized there was nothing in them that I had not already in some form seen in myself. But lo, again, the light that shines in that dark night of the soul, the light that reveals the concept and the reality of God in a place that would have been more symbolic of hell. Lee Iacocca says in his Straight Talk, as I start the twilight years of my life, I try to look back and figure out what it was all about. I'm really still not sure what is meant by good fortune and success. I know that fame and power are for the birds, but then life suddenly closes in on me and comes into focus. There stand my children, and I love them. No matter what you've done for yourself or for humanity, if you haven't given love and attention to your whole family, what have you really accomplished? John DeLorean in his book writes on the lonely moment of his life, charged of all that he'd done and what came into his mind with the children, the lives that he'd betrayed in the process, and ending that whole book of his on a sad note of how his daughter looked at him one day across a table, enjoying the lovely dinner she had just had with her dad. And a couple sitting by near in Hollywood commented on how nice to see father and daughter enjoying life. Until the next day she phoned and she said, you know, Daddy, I'm not happy today, and cried on the phone. This is the way his book ends. He says, what's the matter, sweetheart? He says, Daddy, I looked at a commercial on TV a few minutes ago, And it showed a man walking hand in hand with his daughter. It was beautiful, Daddy. Beautiful garden, beautiful leaves. It was so lovely as the father held his daughter's hand. And Daddy, I'm calling to tell you, it reminded me of the time we used to be happy when I don't have that happiness anymore. A clue to meaning in life is relationships. And the ultimate relationship is only when you find that relationship with God Himself. As Augustine said, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in Thee. Let me anchor it from the abstract to the concrete. Read one quote and I'll be through. See, the pursuit of the Hebrews for centuries was the pursuit of light. You see the psalmist writing, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. The people that sat in darkness have seen a great light. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path." The pursuit of the Hebrews was light. The pursuit of the Greeks was knowledge, that you may know the logos, the whole idea of knowledge, the idea of the academy and the Greek university. The whole idea of Greek culture then was knowledge, to know. So the pursuit of the Hebrews was light. The pursuit of the Greeks was knowledge. The pursuit of Rome was glory. The city that wasn't built in a day, the city to which all roads led. When it was destroyed, Augustine wept and wrote the city of God because he never thought Rome would be destroyed. So there you have it. The pursuit of the Hebrews was light. The pursuit of the Greeks was knowledge. The pursuit of the Romans was glory. Paul, in his letter to Corinth, a city which had become symbolized with depravity and dissoluteness, Paul says this: God, who caused the light to shine out of darkness, has caused His light to shine in our hearts, to give to us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ Jesus, our Lord.
With that, we conclude our 4-day presentation of Ravi Zacharias's message entitled, "Is Atheism Dead? Is God Alive?" Ravi's complete message is a direct answer to Nietzsche's proclamation of God's death. If you missed any part of it, or if you'd like to revisit this material, we invite you to order a copy of the Harvard Veritas Forum. This package contains 2 messages delivered at Harvard University, and a Q&A session with the students is included in the forum. To receive this album for your home library, call us at 1-800-448-6766 and ask for the Harvard Veritas Forum. Our number again is 1-800-448-6766. For more faith-building resources, visit us online at rzim.org. That's rzim.org. Just Thinking is a listener-supported radio presentation of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. Finally, join us tomorrow for a live question-and-answer session with Ravi Zacharias. Until then, keep thinking.